Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. Today in the show, we're going to talk a little about bacterial diseases in crops, especially in corn. If you've got any questions for us or if there's anything you'd like to talk about that's happening on your farm right now, we would love to visit with you. Our number here is 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. You can also email us, radio@agphd.com. We're going to get to the Ag PhD mailbag in just a minute here. Or you can find us on Twitter, Ag PhD Media, Darren Hefty, or Brian Hefty. So I'll just give you a couple of quick things on the bacterial diseases, and then we'll get into the mailbag. But just to start things off, when we discuss diseases in general in most crops, the first thing I always think about is a fungicide. Well, a fungicide is going to do a great job on fungal species. It's not going to do anything for bacteria. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So a lot of times when we're worried about bacterial diseases, oh, and by the way, you might say, well, wait a second, aren't there any bactericides? Well, there aren't any real good ones that we feel super confident about. So as an agronomist, I have a difficult time recommending some product to you that's going to stop a bacterial disease, like let's say Goss's wilt, for example. Am I going to feel comfortable about that? No. So generally speaking, you're looking at variety selection, and then it's just doing everything possible to raise a great crop that's healthy and strong. I mean, it's kind of like human beings. We tell you, take your vitamins, get a good night's sleep, exercise, drink lots of water, all those kind of things. Same thing for your crop. We just want to make sure that you're doing a good job with drainage, fertility, you're controlling the weeds, insects, and diseases that you can control. So you're reducing all the other stresses, and then usually your crop is a lot more tolerant to these bacterial diseases that could hit. The other thing that is kind of unfortunate, though, is a lot of bacterial diseases will enter into plants after they have somehow been damaged. And yes, that could be from some type of mechanical damage that happens out there. But it's wind, it's rain, it's hail, those kind of things you don't have a lot of control over, unfortunately. And if they tatter up your crop a little bit, well, any of those open wounds are where the bacterial diseases can get in. So anyway, we'll talk about that throughout the show today. But right now, let's get to the Ag PhD mailbag.
It's the mailbag!
All right, Brian. First question comes from Mr. Bean, who says, I'm looking at adding a cover crop cereal rye to the operation this year. I'm at a continuous soybean system in Missouri. Bean harvest will be mid-October. Typical frost date is about the same time. Not expecting a ton of growth out of the fall rye, but hopefully it'll get established a little bit. I don't have the most modern equipment, meaning I don't have guidance, so I will be either killing that cover crop pre-plant or planting before the crop has much height to it and then killing it post.
Yep.
I'm wondering, what pre- or residual products would work good with a rye cover without getting tied up in that residue? I do hear folks talking about leaving out the residual at planting time in the burn down pass and just running dual outlook residual early post.
Nope, don't do that. So we're going to talk to you always in soybeans about using a pre. I mean always, 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 don't care what the situation is. So a lot of people worry about this residue tie-up thing. I've never experienced a lot of that. So, Darren, I don't know how you feel about that, but, I mean, I made recommendations into tens of millions of acres.
If you want to spray it post-plant. And if you say, oh, I've got beans that are going to be up tomorrow, I've got tons of residue, and I'm in a dry situation, and the weeds are going to start coming in a couple of days, yeah, I don't expect to get full use out of it. I like to put
that
stuff on earlier when I've got lots of residue.
I don't. I'm fine spraying right when I'm going to plant, or even after I plant. I'm okay with that. As long as I have something in there that is going to kill the weeds. But to Darren's point, and I think where you're going with this, Darren, is if you want a residual herbicide to work, well, you've got to have rain, and you got to have rain quickly if it's late in the season. Now, if it's early in the season, like a lot of times when we plant, there's nothing growing out there. I mean nothing. So it's very, very cold where we farm. But anyway, so there's nothing growing out there. We don't even need a burn down, but we're putting a residual out. Well, if the weeds aren't going to start growing for a couple of weeks, we got a couple of weeks to get a rain. If your weeds are already growing today, yeah, you can burn down what's there, but then you want some residual out of these herbicides to kill what's going to come in the future. So you got to have rain fairly quickly. But anyway, I don't worry about this residue tie-up thing. Long term, it's nothing. And in the short term, yes, it can hurt you a little bit, but it's not that big a deal. So it's funny. I was just talking to my son the other day because he had asked about planting into a standing, living cover crop. And I just said, Zach, this works great for guys in the South, for guys out in the East Coast. It's awesome. It doesn't work here. And the reason why is we don't have enough rainfall. So if we are lacking rain, then it ends up drying things out for us and we have a disastrous crop. Now, if we get a wet year like the last 2 years, it would have worked okay, except for the fact that sometimes it delays us when we want to plant early. A couple of years ago, we had this case where it was a wet spring. It was a wet fall, then it was a wet spring. And anyway, we had some of our turnips and radishes and stuff like that. Might have been wheat or oats. I don't remember what else we had out there. Anyway, it was growing. And so we had a living cover we planted into, and we couldn't plant. It was too wet into that. Whereas where we had killed it off in the fall, we planted just fine. And I'm talking about early planting, like April planting, like right after the frost has come out of the ground. That's when we like to plant. So anyway, in this particular case, I would use residual herbicides, the ones we always recommend. Now, if you're in no-till, it's going to be Prowl. If you were conventional, it'd be trifluralin. But we're going to recommend a yellow, either Prowl or trifluralin. We're going to recommend Metribuzin, and then either Valor or Authority. So I'd throw all those in there. If you want more burn down of what's there now, certainly you can throw in glyphosate, there's Liberty, there's Gramoxone, there's AIM. You have a lot of choices for what else you can throw in depending on the weed spectrum that you need to burn down. But we like those three pre's, the yellow, the Metribuzin, and a PPO, either Valor or Authority, to give you good residual as you go into the season. And yeah, don't get too worried about this residue tie-up. Won't be that big a deal for you. All right, well, stay tuned. We're going to talk about bacterial diseases in crops right after this.
Stop losing money from your stored grain with the Endzone Fan Control System from FarmShop MFG. Hot spots and moisture in your bin can cost you thousands in lost revenue. The Endzone monitors outside conditions to run your fans exactly when you want them to, naturally bringing your grain to ideal temperature and humidity. Master bin management with the Endzone. For more information, visit farmshopmfg.com.
Worried about glyphosate-resistant weeds and grasses in your corn? Unleash the power of new Impact Z herbicide and get the early post-application advantage you've been waiting for. Save $3 per acre when you combine Impact Z with a qualifying insecticide purchase. Go to buy2save3.com for details. Buy2save3 is a service mark, and Impact Z is a trademark owned by Ambac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
Acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, nobody scrutinizes performance like you do. And acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, the consistent performance of Vasgrow brand soybeans helps to keep your profitability out in front, offering leading agronomic expertise and 100% exclusive genetics for strong yield potential. Ask your dealer how much further you can grow when Vasgrow leads the way. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
What's the next big thing from the Roundup Ready Extend crop system? A soybean built on Roundup Ready to Extend technology, or one with glufosinate tolerance? Great news, it's both. Expected soon. Extend Flex Soybeans. Always read and follow IRM where applicable. Grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions. Commercial availability in 2021 is dependent on regulatory approval. No dicamba may be used in crop with Extend Flex Soybeans unless and until approved. And no dicamba formulations are currently registered for such use in the 2021 season. Learn more at extendflexsoy.com.
Back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about bacterial diseases in corn, so you may be able to guess who our first call would be that we'd want to have on for a guest. Of course, it's Tamara Jackson-Zims from University of Nebraska. Tamara, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, I got to ask you a quick question, though, before we get into some of this corn stuff. Talk to us about sorghum. Do we have bacterial disease issues in sorghum as well?
Well, there are some. There's bacterial diseases in probably about every crop, including soybean, too. And there's a number of them in sorghum that but don't really cause noticeable, I guess not, I shouldn't say noticeable, but significant damage. So we haven't worried much about those lately.
Okay, so kind of like bacterial leaf streak then in corn, where it might look worse in a lot of cases than what the yield loss is?
That might be the case, and there may be some natural tolerance there too. In fact, there is a bacterial leaf streak in sorghum caused by a very closely related pathogen. And so we have tried to monitor that a little bit to make sure they're not bouncing back and forth.
Okay, so that kind of brings us back to this topic of bacterial diseases in corn. And we think about rotational issues. If we can rotate out of corn and get to something like soybeans, there are bacterial issues there, but it's different ones. So we'd get away from it a little bit from the pressure.
Well, that's the hope. And so we always recommend crop rotation for these disease issues. There have been some cases, and we are testing this now in a 3-year project, but there have been cases around our state where we've had people tell us that even when they did rotate, they still had quite a bit of bacterial leaf streak. And some of our more recent data tell us now that we have a wide host range, a lot of other species that are susceptible. And although we can't tell for sure, that could be an explanation.
When we talk to farmers about this, many of them will talk about their residue management system. Even the guys in continuous corn will say, well, I've got to do everything I can to get that residue to break down. That gets rid of the home for some of these bacterial and fungal issues. Is that helpful if we can get the residue just to disappear quickly?
Well, it probably is. Most of the pathogens that we deal with are residue-borne, whether it's fungal or bacterial. All of them, except for the rust, for instance, can survive there. And so that's a concern for us, although we understand that can come at some cost, too. The residue has a lot of value, and so we know that can be a tricky game to play.
Yeah, it's certainly not easy, that's for sure. When we're talking about bacterial diseases, Goss's Wilt gets more play, I would say, on a radio show and just talking with farmers. That seems to be one they ask more questions about. I know the corn breeders have been making some strides forward. We're getting some better products out there, but they certainly aren't all good. Was this a big Goss's year in Nebraska, or was it an off year?
We certainly saw some here and there, and I think we've done a lot of good work as far as resistance in our contemporary hybrids. But it seems like, you know, maybe people that don't see it on a year-to-year basis may not be making it a priority to choose those resistant hybrids year after year. And so I would emphasize that that's really important. And you're just one hailstorm away from finding out really that it really is still there.
Yeah, you mentioned that just one storm can come through and it's a big problem. And one thing my brother has always been on, Brian's always big on, hey, if you ever switch hybrids, don't just jump to that next one. Make sure you check it out for disease tolerance, especially for things like Goss's, or that could be one of those situations you talk about where you get burned.
Absolutely.
All right, so when you think about that, so Goss's we're making some progress on, and I think most farmers in areas that have been historically Goss's Wilt areas are catching on, but this thing is spreading. We've got more questions coming out of North Dakota. I was amazed. I was halfway up the state going north, and there are farmers saying, this is a big deal to me, picking late 70-day to mid-80-day hybrids. I got to see the Goss's Wilt tolerance. And I thought, wow, it just wasn't that many years ago that we were talking about this in the 90-day range that, oh my goodness, we need to get better. And now it's the 75 and 80-day corns as well. So I would assume you're probably getting some calls from North Dakota too about, what do you know about Goss's? What do we need to know so this doesn't get to be a big issue?
I agree. We have been hearing about Goss's up there, and it's just been newer to them, and now they've certainly got it full-blown in some of those areas. And so it's I'm sure it's a big challenge for our breeders to keep up with that.
Yeah, it sure is. And it's interesting, too, talking to the breeders. Some of the inbreds that they're using, they can cross a 100-day inbred down with some 80-day material and move some of that down. And I know it's more complicated than I'm going to understand, but they're making improvements there, too. Not quite as good as what we're seeing in the 110-day class, but, again, it hasn't been a big issue there that long. So we think about glosses. We think about bacterial leaf streak. Are there other bacterial diseases in corn that we need to be aware of?
You know, I would say those are the two main ones that we're concerned about that are the most, literally the most visible. And this was a big year for bacterial leaf streak here in Nebraska. It caught a lot of people by surprise, maybe as much as we had in 2016. There's other things that they'll see, though, that I wouldn't worry about. Holca spot, little white dots on the leaves that are not a big concern. Maybe a hybrid here and there may have a little bit more of it. Here in Nebraska, we also have bacterial stalk rot and haven't had a whole lot of that except in some isolated cases. That's the one that stinks really bad, so people often notice that first about it. And so those are probably the main ones on bacteria. We have a few older ones that, like Stewart's wilt, we don't talk much more about that. That was vectored by the corn flea beetle. We haven't seen a whole lot of that except for here and there in seed corn.
Sure.
And then a few other streaky type diseases that we're watching for.
I know one of the big things is just identifying these diseases, and you do such a good job at Nebraska. I know there's a lot of growers that really rely on your department to help them through these things. And gray leaf spot, I think, is one. I've talked to more guys that said, man, I thought I had gray leaf spot and nothing was stopping it. And then I realized it's bacterial leaf streak. They're pretty close. I mean, they look pretty close out in the field. Is there a real key there that you look for to encourage growers, hey, look for this to be able to tell them apart?
Mm-hmm. They sure can look similar. And that's what happened to us in 2015 and 16 when we heard more and more people say that fungicides weren't stopping gray leaf spot. Well, it actually turned out to be bacterial leaf streak. And so since then, we've looked for ways to try to explain it so it's a little more clear. And one of them is when those diseases develop, and often bacterial leaf streak can start as a seedling disease. And when you take those leaves and you hold them up to the light and compare them, bacterial leaf streak produces a yellow pigment, and it's mustard yellow, and it makes the lesions on that leaf glow. Not glow, but it's pretty bright. And that's one way I think it's a little easier to tell it apart. I would also look at the shape of the lesions. When you get both gray leaf spot and bacterial leaf streak, you'll notice the gray leaf spot lesions have smooth edges or margins, much more rectangular. But the edges of a bacterial leaf streak lesion are more irregular and jagged. And so that's probably the easiest ways to tell them apart.
Talking with Tamara Jackson-Zims with University of Nebraska. Tamara, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on. You're always such a wealth of knowledge, and I know our growers really, really appreciate hearing from you.
Well, thank you for all your work. We appreciate it, and have a great rest of your season.
You bet. You too. Yeah, it's coming to a close here, especially with this cool weather here. It starts to feel a lot more like fall, a lot less like summer. And Brian, one of the things that we're still looking at out at plants and making evaluations on is just how they handled some of the disease pressure that we saw this year. We're talking about bacterial disease today.
Yeah, and it's going to get real hard real fast when the leaves are starting to turn brown. So if you can, every year it's nice to be scouting as you go so you see what's really happening out in your fields. A lot of times Darren and I get questions at harvest time and guys say, boy, why do you think my yield was bad in this area of the field? You know, I don't know at this point. So the more you can scout during the season, the better off you are. And certainly with satellite imagery, you can go back a little bit and see when things happen, but you can't figure it out exactly. We'll talk more about bacterial diseases right after this.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop, grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition, Apply less. Expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Your land is a legacy, a challenge from those who tended it before you to build on their foundations. At Corteva Agriscience, we understand what it means to be the stewards of a legacy. We embrace the challenge of building on the foundation of Dow AgroSciences to maintain your trust, to bring new solutions, to help you care for your land. See how we can help build your legacy at rangeandpasture.com.
If you're looking to get the most out of your foliar nutrition and fungicide programs, ask your ag retailer about Nutex EDA from Sipchem Agro. Nutex EDA has been proven to increase foliar micronutrient tissue levels and maintain those levels for an extended period of time. When tank mixed with fungicides, Nutex EDA helps support plant health, resulting in higher quality and yields. Nutex EDA is an affordable and effective solution that should be part of every grower's high-yield toolbox.
Find your full potential and increase your bottom line with branded generic herbicides from Atticus LLC. Tough broadleaf weeds are a hassle, but they're no match for Cavallo from Atticus. Cavallo delivers fast, contact, and residual control so your corn, soybean, and sorghum crops can thrive. Growers across the region count on Atticus for relevant and reliable products that deliver results every time. Ask your local retailer about Atticus products and visit AtticusLLC.com to learn more. For value-based solutions you can trust, turn to Atticus. Always read and follow label instructions.
Maintaining your crops is as important now as it's ever been. Howler, a revolutionary fungicide from AgBiome, can help. It provides long-lasting protection from a broad spectrum of foliar and soil diseases that affect crops. Howler is OMRI listed, has multiple modes of action, and has minimal pre-harvest and re-entry intervals. It's flexible, easy to use, and is available right now. Visit agbiome.com/howler to learn more.
Pentair Hypro Ultra Low Drift Nozzles are your ideal choice for the Enlist E3 herbicide system. With coverage comparable to flat fans and with 90% less drift, ULD nozzles meet all required standards for Enlist applications and provide optimal performance of contact herbicides. Learn more at pentair.com/hypro.
Stop losing money from your stored grain with the Endzone Fan Control System from Farm Shop MFG. The Endzone monitors outside conditions to run your fans so your grain naturally reaches ideal temperature and humidity. For more information, visit farmshopmfg.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Talking about bacterial diseases in corn, also taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. Real happy to have Tom Allen with us with Mississippi State University. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Well, pretty good. We thought that we could give you a little bit of a break from talking about soybean rust today to talk about some corn diseases. Man, has this been the soybean rust year or what down in your neighborhood?
It's just been a rest year, period. That's all I'm used to. It's, you know, I think mild winter and then a early tropical system has kind of showed us what that'll do for the part of the world when it comes to soybean production. Because we've had a lot of people call me and say, you know, man, I just didn't think soybean rust would be an issue this year. It always comes in late. All of a sudden this year you're talking about it again. I'm like, I haven't really been talking about it in 10 years.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know, you can never figure these things out of when it's going to be a problem. Like, talk to us about bacterial disease in corn then. Is there a type of year that shapes up that this is going to be more of a problem, or is it just kind of hit or miss and just it can be erratic a little bit?
I would say it could be erratic. And, you know, you talk to us down in the South, and we don't traditionally have an issue with bacterial diseases in corn. And I think we all kind of sit around and scratch our heads because the Midwest definitely, you know, a lot more corn acres, and you all end up with Stewart's wilt, grasses wilt, bacterial leaf streak. And the only time we ever run into anything in the deep South was 2013, and ran across a little grasses wilt in Louisiana. And since then, I haven't seen any. So I think, you know, it's A lot has to do with the environment, obviously. And I think it's probably too warm here, but that Midwestern climate, for whatever reason, tends to produce a little bit more of an issue when it comes to those bacterial diseases.
I was wondering, too, if it was partly hybrid tolerance, that the tolerance is just better on some of those late-day corns. But do you ever get any early-day corns down there? Do they actually work, or do guys end up just having a bunch of disease issues?
We usually just, well, we end up with real hit or miss disease issues, and it really depends on the year. I mean, 2020 is a great example. Not a lot of northern corn leaf blight, not a lot of gray leaf blight, tons of southern rust. And then, you know, we have this new little thing, crudelary leaf spot. I wouldn't say it's new. It's been around for a while, but it tends to be a newer issue for our farmers down in the southern United States just because it hasn't really reared its ugly head. And now we seem to have more of a climate or more hybrid susceptibility to that, or more residue just because we've grown more corn pretty continuously for the last 10 years. And we don't typically have a lot of farmers that grow a lot of continuous corn. Most of our farmers do a pretty good job rotating.
Yeah, I remember being down in Mississippi probably close to 10 years ago, and just talking to growers that cotton was way down. The price wasn't good, and they were going to plant some corn. I remember going out with a farmer into his first cornfield he'd ever grown, and he said, I'm kind of embarrassed and nervous to have you come from corn country down here and look at this because I don't know if it's good or bad. And it had to be every bit of 200-plus bushel corn. And I said, you know what? You had a home run for your first time down here. And he's like, well, it's just pure luck. I just kind of tried to treat it fertility-wise like a good crop of cotton, and evidently that must work for corn too. So he had done pretty well. I know you can raise good corn.
We've done a pretty good job raising corn, and certainly have, you know, put a lot of research behind that, and have a really great group of farmers that tend to call us for problems and concerns, and hey, can you research this and do that? And, you know, that definitely helps. The whole extension system with our farmers is still alive and well, and that's, you know, beneficial for all of us.
You know, you mentioned, we talked about the soybean rust to start with, and I remember back when that was first big in South America, and growers up here were, there was one year growers were loading up on fungicides, even in the northern part of the United States, that, oh no, it's going to blow up and get us, and it really never has. But what do you do down there for it? I know in Brazil at that time, I made a couple of trips down just to learn more about this, and they said, well, we're just spraying every 21 to 28 days, and we can keep it at bay as long as we don't let it get ahead of us. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Most of our farmers really rely on us to provide the information as to whether or not it's going to be a big issue. And really, 2009 was probably the last year we were really fearful of losing some yield as a result of that. And that year just tended to be really, really wet. And the temperatures were a little more moderate than what they normally are. But I'm sitting here today in Starkville, Mississippi, looking at soybeans, and it's about 94 degrees today. Not what you would consider to be real conducive soybean rust weather. But I think in our production system, the most beneficial thing to suggest is if we continue to do some good rigorous looking through the winter months, make sure that kudzu's died back and it doesn't have a green bridge, and then pay attention to where it really overwinters and watch the early season weather. And if we do run into one of those early tropical systems, then I think getting out and boots on the ground and looking as much as we can to see how much soybean rust we have, and then kind of going from there. But we do an awful lot of automatic fungicide applications in the southern United States. A lot of farmers have embraced that R3, R4 fungicide application. And I think in some cases that's probably helped us in some parts of the South, because it's reduced the yield loss potential from soybean rust.
Sure.
This year, I think this just crept up and kind of caught us out of the blue. I'd seen some early, but when you look at 96 degree temperatures through most of July and parts of August, it's kind of like, and I don't think soybean rust will really blow up that fast. And this year it's blown up in some places because we've had such sporadic rainfall totals throughout the state. Eastern part of the state's had more rain than the western part of the state. And I think that has tended to play into the environment that soybean industry really prefers.
You know, the other thing, I know earlier this summer, just reading material that you're putting out, I do try to keep up with what's going on with a lot of the pathology departments around the country. And I know you were talking about phytotoxicity and different fungicides that guys were using, and that there was a varietal response where some varieties just seemed to be more susceptible to some phyto from different products. Are there any that really stood out that you would say, you know, more times than not when we sprayed this product, we had some phytotoxicity?
The number one product we really get phyto from is Stratego Yield. And that the bear probably hates me saying that, but there's a lot of truth to that. And usually I follow that with, in the years that we've looked at phyto in my program in Stonesville, and we've gotten really good phyto for the better part of the last decade in most of our plot trials, we've never recorded a yield reduction associated with that phytotoxicity. The only times we've run across kind of a yield cost associated with that was when we were looking at numbered compounds that were not necessarily registered in soybean.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, some of those resulted in excessive amounts of phytotoxicity, and you ended up with a little bit of a yield cost associated with that. But any of the things we've looked at in the last decade that have been labeled in soybean, even if it produces a good amount of phytotoxicity, you don't end up with a yield reduction. And usually what I tell folks is, if you're spraying a fungicide that can produce phyto, and really any fungicide that contains a triazole can produce phyto depending upon the variety and the environment and everything else, I tend to suggest if you're going to apply it, put an eighth of a percent of a crop oil in there with it, and that should reduce the amount of phyto that you'll see associated with that. Whenever you increase your adjuvant percentage, you'll end up with more phytotoxicity.
Interesting. Yeah, it's good. Good tip. It's really fun when we get a chance to talk to folks around the country with lots of different experience. We're talking with Tom Allen here with Mississippi State, and certainly fights a lot more heat and humidity than we get up where we farm, and different situations coming up like soybean rust this year being really bad. Tom, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on today. We'll have to have you again sometime.
Hey, I appreciate it. You guys take care.
You bet. Thanks. Talking about bacterial diseases in corn on our show today, and also taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. We'll be right back.
A history of success means proven performance, but let's call performance what it is: profitability. And boosting yours, no matter what the season brings, is the goal of DeKalb brand corn. Backed by exclusive genetics, whole farm solutions, and unmatched dealer support, let nothing shake your perseverance. Ask your dealer how DeKalb brand corn can help you realize a future of performance. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Revitec fungicide from BASF has been specifically developed for the selective soybean grower who doesn't compromise. If you think good is good enough, if you're okay with just achieving rather than overachieving, if average is your goal, this is not the fungicide for you. Revitec fungicide, brand new chemistry, 3 no-excuse modes of action, 0 modes of compromise. Sounds like the fungicide for you. Revitec fungicide from BASF, that's smart. Always read and follow label directions.
When it comes to effective herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. They've been bringing growers trusted brands like Burnmaster, Scorch, and Spitfire for decades, made right here in the USA. What's your favorite Nufarm brand? Email it to turnuptheburn@nufarm.com and you'll be entered to win a monthly $1,000 product giveaway. In these unprecedented times, you're facing unprecedented pressure. Nufarm's here to help.
Hey, Adam, new drone?
Not just any drone. I mounted a laser on it to take out weeds.
Look out for that tree! In the power lines!
Oh, it's in for the house.
There's a simpler way to protect spring wheat from weeds. Perfect Match Herbicide. The broadest spectrum weed and grass control in one product. Learn more at PerfectMatchHerbicide.com. Always read and follow label directions.
The laser.
Oh my goodness, did you see Bob's gorgeous soybean rows?
Totally. I couldn't believe how clean and weed-free his entire field looked. I'm like, so jealous.
I heard he started using this new post-applied residual herbicide called Perpetuo, and it's burned down and long-lasting residual powers, making his soybeans, like, literally the talk of the town.
Ah, so Perpetuo's his secret.
Yep.
Talk to your retailer or visit Valent.com/Perpetuo to learn more. Always read and follow label instructions.
You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Talking about bacterial diseases in corn and taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. When you think about those bacterial diseases, I think one of the big takeaways here is, and you're aware of this too, you've got to pick good hybrids with good tolerance. And the challenge gets to be on things like bacterial leaf streak, where not many companies have got decent ratings on their hybrids. So they can't really tell you, well, you know, this one, we saw some in last year. Well, I don't know how well you can rely on that, I guess, but that's the challenge with some of the new ones. With Gosses, I think we got a much better handle on it. It's kind of, well, I'm planting corn from a couple different companies. This one, it's got to be at least a 3. Then I can plant it. This one, maybe I can get by with a 4. And it's fine on their rating scale. They rate them a little different. There isn't a universal system that gets used. And that can be a little bit tricky if you're switching companies. So you do have to have a good relationship with your seed corn provider. And also, it's just a smart deal to get out in fields and see stuff. For example, I've got a soybean breeder that just called this week and he said, hey, guess what? We've got this particular disease. Don't see it very often. It happened to hit this one plot I've got really bad. And it's 3.5 hours from where you live. I'm like, ah, oh, man, it's a little bit of a drive. But how often do you get that, where something actually hits a plot where they've got tons of different varieties out there and you can see, all right, we can actually tell how they did. Now, in some cases, there's predictable things like iron deficiency chlorosis, for example. You've got predictable spots in fields that you can see. But Gosses wilt, bacterial leaf streak, do you really know where they're going to hit hard every single year? Not really. As we were talking with Tom Allen down at Mississippi State, sometimes conditions are absolutely right where you should have lots of bacterial disease and you just don't. And as Tamara Jackson-Zims at Nebraska said, you know, you're just one hailstorm away from having a pretty good Gosses wilt trial, and you may or may not get that. And I get it. In some of the university trials where they can run with the hail machine, they can make some of that happen, and they can inoculate trials. And if you get a chance to look at trials like that, do it, because it's well worth the time to see how things really handle the pressure.
I hate to even bring this up, but this is where, I mean, as you were talking about all that, Darren, I just kept thinking about this whole coronavirus deal, and it just, when it's an invisible enemy, you just have to do everything you can to get yourself as healthy as possible. So if you happen to get it by some fluke, then your body can fight it off. It's the same thing with our crops. So that's why we talk all the time here on the show about drainage, about good fertility, about getting your soil pH right, about weeds, insects, diseases. It's all about reducing the stress on that crop. And when we've reduced all the other stresses, if you only introduce the one, the bacterial disease, it doesn't take as much yield from you. So yes, you can work on variety selection, and yes, there are some bactericides you could try. I don't expect you're going to get much, but you could try those things. So, I mean, there are a few things out there, but, I mean, really what it comes down to is let's just try everything possible to have a good, healthy crop, and hopefully, if bacterial disease shows up, it's going to be okay. Darren, anything else?
No, but we've got a pile of Ag PhD mailbag questions to get to.
Yep, let's jump back into those.
Okay, this one comes from Montana Dad, who says, when doing your grid soil sampling, how deep are you running on your farm?
On our farm, we go down to 6 inches. Now, we've done stuff before to 12 inches, and the reason why is in some fields where we've done lots of strip till over the years, we just felt that was important to get some of that fertility that could be deeper. So you can do whatever you want on your farm. I know a few people that go 0 to 4. I know a few people that go 0 to 8. Most everybody goes 0 to 6, but there are some who go 0 to 12. So here's what I would suggest. If, let's say you're going 0 to 6 like we are. So we do that on all the acres. Any acres that we're going to sample, okay? But then we pick a few spots, and we'll do a 6 to 12 inch, a 12 to 18, and an 18 to 24. So just a few spots. We're not going to spend a lot of money, but I do kind of want to know what's down below. What we've found over the years of doing that is our 0 to 6, the variability is very wide, let's put it that way. But when we get down deeper, we don't have near as much variability, okay? So I like to phrase it as, we haven't screwed it up. You may find the same thing on your farm, but nevertheless, it's whether it's good, bad, whatever, it's nice to know what's down there. Because when you start digging around, you're going to find lots of roots down below 6 inches. So it only makes sense to start thinking about, well, what do I have for fertility down there? How is the pH? What's my drainage like? All these things. So I'd start looking at least a little bit deeper. But yes, we run 0 to 6 primarily.
All right, thanks for the question. Okay, this one comes from Bernard, and he has some helpful information here for people thinking about cover crops. And he said, back in the early 1990s, they were in a physics class, and they were talking about the energy that raindrops would hit soil with and how much soil splash there would be.
And compaction.
They looked at kale as a potential cover crop.
Okay.
Well, they got a variety of kale that didn't flower well, and it flopped out all over their growing pots. And that one had such an extensive root system, but it was really weak. It really spread out and covered the ground, and it died and rotted within a growing season. And he said, thinking back at that, he goes, I see so many people using brassicas now as cover crops. I just thought I'd mention this, that maybe since that one really didn't put on much seed, that you could buy it cheap.
Yep.
And it might be a good cover crop for people to consider. Bernard, thank you so much. Really appreciate that. And you're right. When we get a cover out there, that really helps with rainfall and absorbing the pounding of that rain and reducing erosion and getting something that covers the ground well would be really beneficial. All right, one from Richard. He said, you guys were talking about why soybean yields stink. And he said, I just wanted you to know, I've been doing several different fertility timings as part of my complete system to help my soybeans. Hey, that's a great point. When we think about pushing the easy button, and you know, it'd sure be easy. I got heavy soil. I'm in an area that doesn't get too much rain. I'll just put all my fertility out in one shot. Or worse yet, you know what? I'm going to plant corn, so I'm going to put a bunch of fertilizer on the corn, and hopefully there'll be some left for my soybeans. I think those two systems are not really the ideal fertility program for soybeans, and when you think about how much fertility those soybeans need, especially when they're trying to flower and produce pods and beans, they need a lot late in the season. So having good fertility availability late in that season has got to be huge.
Okay, but here's where I completely disagree with what you just said, Darren. You said heavy soil, not a lot of rainfall, and putting it all on up front
Brian
could
likes
be a
to
mistake.
Push the easy button.
That's not the easy button. I don't want to do it that way, but I don't have a choice because here's what we found. We went the last 2 months with basically no rain. So anything we put on here in the last 2 months, which you would do, because in the last 2 months, that's when soybeans were podding, trying to fill out those pods, wasn't working so well in our geography when we didn't have rain. So if I had to put anything on in the last 2 months, it flat out wouldn't have worked. Now, sure, you could have put on a tiny little dose of a foliar fertilizer, and maybe it would have gotten in because we did have decent humidity all the way up until late August. But every area is a little different. And so ideally, sure, I'd love to time these fertility products out maybe a little differently than we do on our farm. But when we're in such a dry area, it's hard to do. I want to get that out early. The other thing we found with soybeans is it seems like it responds better to fertility that's already in the ground as opposed to applied fertility in a lot of cases. Part of the reason is because the root system is so small. It's roughly 1/5 the size of corn. 1/5 the root mass of corn. That's it. So when you start thinking about it, you go, wow, yeah, it's not able to, those roots aren't able to explore a lot of the soil with soybeans. So what are you going to do? That's where we talk about maybe place it a little bit different. Certainly you could go to a narrower row spacing. A lot of guys go 10-inch rows, 7-inch rows, something like that. You can do that. There are drawbacks to that, but that's one advantage. You can maybe recover some of that fertilizer a little bit better and more quickly. But, I mean, fertility is challenging when you're in a dry area. So you just have to think a little differently. It is also challenging when you have irrigation and sand because you know it's not going to stick around longer. So that's why we talk all the time on the show about just varying things up based on your conditions. That's what we're trying to help you with so you can get smarter about fertility overall and do things right for you and your farm. All right, we'll continue answering your questions in the Ag PhD mailbag. If you've got a question for us, just email it in at radio@agphd.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
Oh my goodness, did you see Bob's gorgeous soybean rows?
Totally. I couldn't believe how clean, weed-free his entire field looked. I'm like, so jealous.
I heard he started using this new post-applied residual herbicide called Perpetuo, and its burned down and long-lasting residual power is making his soybeans, like, literally the talk of the town.
Ah, so Perpetuo's his secret.
Yep.
Talk to your retailer or visit Valent.com/Perpetuo to learn more. Always read and follow label instructions.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at soilwarrior.com.
As a little girl, I always wanted to run the combine because it meant I was helping Dad. And Dad always said, farmers are helpers. I'm teaching that to my daughters, that farmers help our family, our neighbors, and our community. It's what I do at work. I help farmers get the equipment they need. My name is Kim. I'm a farmer, and I work for Case IH.
Case IH, built by farmers.
You would never plant seed or apply herbicide with a 20% success rate. So why are you still applying phosphorus fertilizer with a maximum availability of only 20%? Double your phosphate availability and increase yields with NutriCharge from AgroTech USA. NutriCharge's patent-pending technology protects phosphorus from negative chemical reactions that tie up your fertilizer investment. NutriCharge performs across all soil types and pHs. Contact AgroTech USA or your local Van Deese supply representative today.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotam North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. We're right in the middle of the Ag PhD mailbag time, taking your calls and agronomic questions throughout the rest of the show. Our phone lines are open at 844 844 AGPHD, or you can send us an email, radio@agphd.com. Got a desperate email here from Van. He said, I've got a garden with sweet corn, bell peppers, squash, etc. Earwigs are getting into the bell peppers and sweet corn. What can I use to kill those disgusting little creatures, and when should we spray? Well, the answer of when you should spray is right now. We don't want to lose anything. And, you know, here's one of the things. We tolerate all the time, oh, we need to see this level of feeding out in our soybean crop or our alfalfa crop or whatnot. But if it's food that humans are going to consume, our tolerance for feeding is zero. We don't want to see anything. We don't want to see kernels that look like they're damaged or diseased or anything like that. And that's what happens when you have bugs that are feeding on them. You know, I think about earwigs, and they're nocturnal guys that love cool and wet environments. And if you've got mulch and debris out in that garden, that would be the first thing I would do is get that mulch out of there, because that's where they're living. Because in addition to eating on your crop and eating things like aphids and mites, they also feed on decaying organic matter. So if you can take that food source away, that would be good. And also a place where they can hide, get that out of there if you can. And what some people have done is just go with dry gravel or sand or something like that instead as a cover, because they don't like that and they can't really survive in that very well. That would be something that you could do. That's a lot of work. If you just want to spray, there are a lot of different products out there. Many of the killers for earwigs have got diazinon in them or bifenthrin. Those would be a couple options. Brian, talk about bifenthrin a little bit. That's one that would be pretty safe for you to be around, but you still want to use precautions as you're spraying it out there in the garden.
Well, it's just bifenthrin is one of the pyrethroids. So we will occasionally talk about these really inexpensive pyrethroids where the full rate is less than $2 an acre. Those are commonly the second generation pyrethroids. So that'd be more like Warrior, Asana, and all the different generics, Serpent, Kendo, Lambda, Psi, you name it. Anyway, bifenthrin is the third generation pyrethroids. And so this goes back a long time ago. I mean, they came out, I don't know, 30 years ago or something like that. But still, the third generation is basically bifenthrin, that active ingredient. So that'd be Capture, Brigade, those kind of products. Excellent, excellent insecticide. A little more residual than the other pyrethroids, but it also costs a little more money. The advantage for us in our region is we get spider mite control here. Now, it doesn't work everywhere, and it doesn't work in all spider mite species, but on the spider mites we have around here, bifenthrin works quite well. Like I say, just a little bit more residual, but, I mean, and that's pretty nice. You don't have to spray quite as often, but, you know, still, these are insecticide products, and so we just always tell people, follow the label, wear your personal protective equipment, and even though, yeah, a pyrethroid's never going to kill anybody, that's the bug killer from the chrysanthemum flower. That's what it's derived from. So it's not like it's super dangerous or anything, but just use your head, be careful, follow the label.
Thanks for the question, and good luck with keeping those earwigs out of your garden. Let's go next to a question here from Hunter. He's in Central North Carolina. He said, my dad and I have a small recreational farm that we're using for wildlife, and we like to plant a wheat and clover mix in a couple of our fields in the wintertime. We've got a tough time, though, controlling pigweed in those fields.
Yep.
Wondering if there's anything I could use pre-emerge to control pigweed in wheat and clover. Well, one of the things I'm thinking about, Brian, is Sharpen. Now, I don't know what it's going to do to that clover. It's not going to be great to the clover,
no.
But it's not going to be terrible either. That would be an option, especially if you don't care how well that clover does, if it struggles a little bit. Sharpen is a product that we can use in wheat. We can use even a couple ounces of Sharpen in wheat. But in crops like soybeans, for example, which would be a relative to clover, we can only get by with an ounce. Otherwise, it dings our soybeans a little bit. I would imagine you'd ding some clover a little bit, too. Boy, other than that, I don't know what to tell you on that. We often talk about planting these in different spots. Now, one thing that you might possibly do
But hold up. Okay, so first of all, we can't recommend Sharpen to you. Sharpen is not labeled on clover, so just scratch everything Darren just told you. As agronomists, we can't recommend things off-label, and that is absolutely off-label.
So it's not labeled at any rate on clover?
No. I mean, right on the label, it's going to tell you it'll kill clover. So So no, you can't do that.
Well, I was thinking about it's this wheat. Fine. Say that it's soybeans and wheat, and you've got a product you can use it 2 ounces on the wheat, but only 1 ounce in the soybeans. You can still use an ounce.
Yeah.
You just aren't going to get a tremendous amount of residual.
Yeah, but that doesn't answer his question because he doesn't want to raise soybeans. He wants to raise clover.
All right.
So no, the answer is no. We don't have anything that you can use for residual. We've got plenty of burn down products.
What about Valor? You can use Valor out in front of wheat. You can use Valor and alfalfa, and I don't know what species of clover
it
is.
You really can't, because like Valor and wheat, you got to do it a month in advance. Well, in a month, a lot of the residual's gone. So what good did that do?
I'm just trying to find an answer. Now, here's the other alternative, Brian.
There isn't one.
What if you did it this way? What if you planted the wheat and the clover in strips? So you had a strip of pure wheat, then you had a strip of pure clover. Now, all of a sudden, you have some different weed control options that could potentially be used. So then you could treat each strip differently. It wouldn't be the same product across the whole thing. So I don't know if that wheat-clover mix is this real big deal for you that, man, they really want to eat some of the wheat and they want to eat some of the clover.
Okay. All right, let's talk about something that we could actually do. So here's what I'd probably say, and you're not going to like this, but there's nothing that you can use. And this is part of the reason why we tell people all the time, please don't plant wheat and clover together. I mean, raise two separate crops separately, and then you can produce more tonnage. But when you're just doing it for what you're talking about here, which is basically a food plot, then you're kind of left with what it is. So if you really wanted to kill the pigweed out, you could let them grow really tall, use a wick, and then have, let's say, dicamba or 2,4-D in the wick that rubs across these plants. And if you have it at a strong enough dose, that would kill them. So, I mean, that's certainly an option for you, but it's going to obviously hurt your wheat and clover. I mean, just the all those pigweeds that are going to get in there. But the pigweeds are going to get taller than the wheat and clover. I can pretty much guarantee you that. So that's why I say you could go across the top with a wick so it would never touch the wheat or clover. And that's about all I got. So other than that, you know, yeah, people have used, let's say, Buctrel, but Buctrel is pretty weak on pigweed species. I just don't have a lot of options for you. I mean, there's nothing pre, there's nothing really post, so that's why we just don't love that mix. It's very, very challenging for weed control.
All right, thanks for the question, Hunter. Next one comes from BK, who said, I was watching one of your videos on sunflower production. I'm wondering, why are you spraying after harvest? Well, that's a good question, BK, and I guess the video you're watching was not a real recent one either that we had out, but many times, depending on what that crop rotation is going to be, if those sunflowers are getting harvested in an area where there's still growing season left, there may be some problem weeds out there that somebody was trying
Absolutely.
To get. Could have been a post-harvest burn down. It also could be, depending on the crop rotation, it could be spraying a pre to have some residual weed control out there for the next crop that's going to be planted.
Yep.
And again, here's something where, depending on where someone is farming, that might be a good option for you too, where you could get out there, get that pre out, and give it some time to get working in the soil.
Yep.
Hey, thanks for checking out our videos, OBK. We really appreciate that. Get this one from James. He said, I've got a couple of weeds in my lawn, and I thought I'd compare them to the pictures that you guys had out there so I could clean them up and stop spreading them. Hey, thanks, James. Yeah, I'm glad you're checking out our videos and keeping up with us on weed control options. I agree with you. You want to get those weeds before they get out of hand, whether it's in a yard or out in a field. All right, last one here comes from Matt. He said, I was watching just some random YouTube videos on corn nutrition, and I came across a video that I'll send you a link to. Somebody from Purdue was saying potassium does not directly affect yield. And I'm sure this would make Brian's head spin since he beats that potassium base saturation drum every chance he gets. Just wondering if you would want to get that person on your radio show for a little
bit. It had to have been taken out of context, because if potassium didn't affect yield, well, then why would we apply it? So that doesn't even make sense. They're not that crazy. They know that potassium affects yield. Everybody in the world knows potassium affects yield of all crops. It affects many things in the plant, everything from standability, stalk strength, grain quality, you name it. Potassium is a big, 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 big deal. On our farm, it has affected soybean yield more than it's affected corn yield, in part because you look at a great soybean crop, takes even more potassium than a great corn crop. But yeah, potassium's important in every plant in the world.
And if your crop is short in any of the essential nutrients, you're more likely to have issues with disease. Today we talked about bacterial diseases in corn on our show. Thanks for listening. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.